Good morning. Good morning, friends. It is 10 a.m. I'm Jay Barrett, and you're listening to the Kenai Conversation here on listener-supported public radio, KDLL. Today, we have what I like to think of as KDLL's own political and social and historical guru, former Mayor John Williams, mayor of the city of Kenai and the borough of Kenai. Good morning, John.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Good. Why don't you go ahead and pull that mic just a little closer to yourself there.
It's good to be with you today.
Yeah, always always a pleasure to have you here. How was your holidays?
Pretty good, pretty good. We had the whole family in except for a couple of the kids that didn't make it, but we had a good gathering.
Oh, I bet. I've been to Christmas at your house, and it is a wild scene seeing all those kids opening presents.
Oh, yeah. We have a lot of fun there.
Man. Well, I'm happy to have you here because I know I'm glad I caught you before you snowbirded it out. I was kind of surprised you were still in town, actually.
Yeah, you know, it's been kind of a tough winter, and we've stuck around to make sure everything's all right. And probably, I don't know just when, but sometime in the next month or so, we may exit for a couple of months, you know, a month and a half, 2 months, about all I can afford to be away from Kenai. I love the place, you know.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, Tucson's nice in the winter.
Yeah, Phoenix. I'm about 50 miles southeast of the Phoenix airport, so in that general area.
Were you down there last, I guess it was summer, when it got so hot that they couldn't fly airplanes out of the airport there?
No, we leave before it gets that hot. I usually, no later than June the 5th or 6th, I think, is the latest we ever stay. And by that time, it's up over 100, 110. I've seen it hit 117. I'm out of there.
Oh, yeah. That was about the time I was in Silver City, New Mexico.
Oh, yes.
And I was going to drive down to near Tucson. But I saw on the news that it was so hot, airplanes couldn't fly.
Right. That's true. There's not enough lift. The air is just too thin, you know, and they won't chance it. So.
Yeah. Density altitude, right?
Yep. Exactly right, yeah.
Boy, so I decided to go back to, I decided to go up to Utah where it was only 100 degrees.
Yeah, it says I'm going further north until it cools down.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a lot of interesting things that we could talk about that are in your bailiwick here, some that we were talking about before we went on, but I was hoping to toss up first the legislature, which gaveled in yesterday, and the governor's got a state of the state address tomorrow. What are you hoping comes out of this legislature? It is an election year.
Well, yes, and that presents some political problems for the players within the legislature because as much as they need to address the subject of the deficit, $2.5 billion deficit, they also want to be reelected, and that always presents a dichotomy of thought. My hope is that they'll do it a little quicker than they did last year, that they'll look at the election season and say it's time for us to be home. We call for a 90-day session. Last year's session ran, I don't know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 250 days, not the single session, but the multiple sessions. It cost us a lot of money. I'm hoping that they'll get their job done and come home and campaign. I like to see them on the campaign trail.
Have you heard of any interesting candidates?
No, not at this point. I think it's a little early yet. There are some major candidates out of the Anchorage area that are announcing, but it's a little early for down here. I'm not even sure that there's going to be any challengers. We'll just have to wait and see how that plays out.
We were talking earlier about the price of oil. You mentioned that it's been going up lately. That is always that always makes things easier in the Alaska legislature.
Yes, it does, and I think that a lot of the companies are gearing up for a more viable season this year than they were last. I think that North Slope crude has approached $70 a barrel. I'm not sure where it's at this morning. It's probably March is probably down around the high 60s. But even Brent and West Texas Intermediate are all up above 60. So we're looking a little bit better, I think.
Yeah, actually, West Texas Intermediate, $64. Brent is $69.
Yeah. So we ride right about where Brent rides, so that puts us at $69 a barrel.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Alaska North Slope, West Coast sales, $69 even.
Right on the nail head, see?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that is, that's something. I mean, $70 a gallon oil is almost, reasonable.
Yes, it is.
Isn't it?
I think, you know, when lifting costs run between 30 and 50, depending on where you're at, 70 puts a profit margin on it.
Yeah, and it puts a little money in the state's coffers.
It does, and you know that's the one thing the legislature has done over the years. Many times when we were in tight situations where our revenue did not approach our expenditures, we always dealt on the future. And I think this is exactly what the legislature has done over the last couple of seasons. They've dealt on the future, hoping. Hope will run out. There's no doubt about that. In fact, our hope chest, if you will, is getting emptier and emptier. Depending on revenues this year, we're going to draw down a sufficient amount to put us into a dangerous situation financially. Unless, of course, the legislature steps in and does some of the dastardly things that they need to do in order to save the state, and that's yet to be seen.
Sure. Well, among those things, I think that some people consider dastardly is the manipulation of the size of the permanent fund dividend.
Well, and that's all legal, too. See, that's the thing about it. So many people misunderstand the purpose and reason and operation of the permanent fund. There's absolutely nothing in the law that prevents the legislature from spending all of the known earnings, not the ones that are dedicated to the corpus, but the earnings of the permanent fund that have been designated in the past for dividend checks, do not have to go to dividend checks. That's the legislature's call, or the governor's call, because he does have veto item control over the budget. The appropriations for the permanent fund must be appropriated under law. Legislature has to do that, or the governor has to step in and intervene. The governor has veto action to say to the legislature, no, there isn't going to be a permanent fund this year. So, you know, it's there.
Yeah. Do you think Governor Walker signed his termination slip when he did that, or the legislature?
He made it awfully tough to run for governor again. There's no doubt about it. Now, you talk about filing for the office. There's a lot of people that are going to be bouncing on that one. He's going to have a tough race. How it comes out depends on what the legislature does this year. People of Alaska have been noted for their forgiveness, you know. And we'll just have to see how the legislature plays out.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of oil and gas, the president a week or two ago opened up all of Alaska's waters to oil and gas exploration, and then he exempted Florida, and Bristol Bay is off the table, I understand. But it includes all of Cook Inlet, which, you know, there are regular lease sales, and we were talking about the Shelikof Strait earlier as well. What do you think about this move?
Well, I think that the governor should petition the president and the Congress to at least take the Shelikof Strait off the map. You know, drilling in the lower inlet can be done in a variety of ways that are safe. For example, an operation that's going on down at Anchor Point right now, Blue Crest. Blue Crest chose to drill from shore to an offshore site rather than setting a jackup rig out in the inlet. And they've had success at drilling a couple of wells. They're in production now on a limited basis, and that can be done. Some of the lower lands, federal lands, that are further out in the water, are, of course, are going to require jackup rigs to deal with. And in the lower inlet, you're probably relatively safe. If we haven't had that many major spills in the upper inlet, I doubt we'll have them with the new technology in the lower inlet. Now, however, again, in my opinion, the Shelikof Strait should be put off limits.
Right, you're telling me a story about them using a semi-submersible one
right.
time. That...
In the early days, this was back in the 60s, there was Marathon Oil had a semi-submersible that they sat in the Shelikof Strait. And it's rumored that the storms that season took it through 100-foot rolling seas. Now, I don't know if the Shelikov is that bad, but it was rumored to be that. They had a tremendous amount of trouble. They almost lost the platform. They lost several anchors, broke loose. They managed to succeed in containing it, and they kept it and were able to recover. The tremendous tides and the tremendous currents and the wind and the weather in the Shelikov Strait is something that nobody really wants to go through.
That's absolutely true. As you know, I spent the last 12 years in Kodiak.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of shipwrecks around the Kodiak archipelago happened on the Shelikov side.
Yeah.
Vast majority of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, they tell stories of, you know, two fishing boats traveling together and the seas come up and one of them disappears.
Never to be seen again.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. No, you know, you would think that a channel like that protected on both sides by land would be a fairly quiet area. You'd think it would be sheltered. But the way the Gulf Current runs, it runs in through that, and it starts picking up speed. It's like turning on the high-pressure pumps, and it starts picking up speed. And when it starts rushing down through the straits, it just gets faster and worse and more grinding, and the winds come up, and it's a terrible thing.
Yeah. Bernoulli's principle.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's shuttling down there and just, you know, just like a carburetor.
Yeah.
You know, I read something the other day on the Alaska Historical Society's page. They have a Today in History, Alaska History. Mm-hmm. And on Mondays, so that would be the 15th, in 1957, I don't have it pulled up on my computer right now, mm-hmm. but Chugach Electric in 1957 had filed to put in a nuclear power plant in Kinnick Arm to power South Central Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard about that?
No, I never did hear about that. Now, I know we did have a nuclear power plant Greeley. In fact, it was the second reactor that actually became the power plant. The first reactor was contaminated with seawater, and they had to send it out and take it out. The second nuclear reactor is the one they put in the power plant up there.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
At the air station?
Yeah, Fort Greeley, where the missiles are at today. Now, I'm not sure just what kind of power they're still using, whether it's nuclear or not, but there were, you know, we have our anti-missile systems there now.
Right. Right, which I don't know if they would have helped Hawaii the other day.
Well, it would have been rather quick. The response time is very quick. I'm not sure if the range would have intercepted one on its way to Hawaii. Very definitely the range will intercept those on their way to the mainland. You know, I spent 3.5 years at Clear Air Force Station in the ballistic missile early warning system in the early days. It's fully active again. They're back up and running with what they call phased array radar rather than the old-fashioned kind. And they're in support, of course, of Fort Greeley's missile launch capabilities.
Yeah. Did you know that Fort Greeley, or the name anyway, was originally on Kodiak?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, there was a Fort Greeley on Kodiak, and then they closed that, and then they named the fort in up near Fairbanks that.
You know, a lot of people don't remember, but Wildwood Air Force Station was once an Army base.
Oh.
It was an Army base and up until about 1956, I believe it was, when they converted over to Air Force. So,
and it was a listening station, wasn't it?
It was a listening station, yeah. It was a transponder from Vietnam to the Pentagon. They brought, you know, information in here and then sent it on. We were in touch with them, of course. We were through the entire White Alice system. We were in touch with them on a regular basis from Clear. But, yeah, they had Hughes put in the first large tracking dish that tracked the early satellites at Wildwood.
Oh, wow. Man.
Yeah.
But they never had jet airplanes like the one at the airport.
Well, they never. It was not an air base per se with airplanes. No, it was a listening station and electronic devices. Although, speaking of jets, the regular Air Force out of Elmendorf used to use the Kenai Airfield as a practice place for years. They had the little T-33 jets that came down. That's the reason we have a T-33 at the airport today. It's a historical reminder.
Aha. Yeah, well, maybe someday we'll have an F-22, because I see those things flying over all the time.
There's talk of by the airport commission that they wanted to see about bringing a different model in and setting it up there as well. It's a very, very long process to do that. I went through that when we put the T-33 there, and it took 2 or 3 years. Of course, we were involved in Operation Desert Storm in the early 90s as well, and that held it up for a while. But I just recently went through the history of acquiring that T-33, and it just astounds me at the amount of paperwork we went through just to get it there.
I can imagine. Man. Continuing on the energy talk here, we were talking about, before we went on the air, liquefied natural gas, LNG. They're planning on putting a plant up here in Nikiski. You didn't sound too optimistic that it was going to happen anytime soon.
Well, you know, I'm moving along in years. I'll be 79 here in the spring. I'm not sure if I have enough time left to see the dedication of that facility. It's a very iffy thing. You know, there's been a lot of publicity about, oh, the Chinese have signed on, the Chinese have done this, the Chinese have done that. The one thing they haven't done is put up any cash. The old saying, show me the money, show me the money. When I see contracts that are, signed and indications of hundreds of millions of dollars being placed either in escrow or in contracts, then I'll begin to feel much better about the future of it. Right now, it's got a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. So do you think it's premature that the borough is thinking about which road to build to get to the rest of Nikiski then?
Well, partially and partially not. And the reason is that the bluff is creeping closer to the only road out there that's paved and used on a full-time basis. You can use the emergency route, but I would hate to see us drop back 50 years to using a gravel road to Nikiski. That's where we were 50 years ago. So the state is going to have to answer the question as to what to do with that section of road that's about to fall over the bluff.
You know, I was I drove up the North Road here the other day, and I got to thinking that I have a piece of Nikiski history missing. Did it grow up around the industry, or did the industry come after much of the community was there?
It grew up around the industry. When we first came here 50 years ago, we moved into Carl Mertz's Bernice Lake Trailer Court. Virtually everything out there in those days was trailer courts. There were sparsely spotted homesteads. A couple by the name of Robin Hood owned the homestead that the Tesoro Refinery is on right now. McGann's had already begun to develop, or began in the midst of developing McGannville there in Nikiski when the platforms were beginning to arrive, and that was dates back to, I believe, 1965. Between 1965 and 1970, the entire industry grew like crazy out there, just blossomed. And of course, that led to a large settlement of people that were there. Prior to that, there weren't that many people lived out there at all.
Huh. And also, what crossed my mind when I drove out there is, whatever happened to BP's GTL demonstration plant?
That was strictly a demonstration project. That was bought on. Actually, I give Paul Connell a lot of credit for that, because Paul grew up and was raised here. He went to work in the public relations division for BP. And when it was decided that they wanted to do a little plant, they thought about the North Slope, and they thought, you know, where else they could put one. Paul reminded them at the time that we had a lot of gas down here, that we could use it, politically speaking, because a lot of BP's employees lived in Kenai, and it would be a good public relations thing. And we needed a little boost in our economy as well. So they brought it in and built it here. And oddly enough, it could have been built anywhere in the entire world and functioned the same way, where there was a supply of gas. The reason being was that it was satellite tied to technology. You could manipulate it from Prudhoe Bay or from England, London. You could manipulate it from Houston. You could do just about anything you wanted. And the engineers, you know, had a field day with it.
Huh. Whatever happened to it?
Well, it just finally got to the point where it wasn't reasonable to operate it. It cost a lot of money. It only produced, I don't know, 500 or 600 barrels a day when it was running. They would sell that over to Tesoro and blend it in with their fuel air. And it didn't run all the time. And it was an experimental project that finally saw that the conclusion was it could be done. It was expensive. Whether or not they wanted to build a much larger plant based on the operations of the pilot plant, it was decided no. So mm-hmm. went from there.
And we should explain to our listeners that GTL, they're taking natural gas and essentially turning it into light crude oil, right?
That's correct, yes. It was turned into, by molecular manipulation, unlike LNG. LNG is just a big refrigerator. You just cool it down to 220 below zero and ship it. It remains liquid state. GTL, on the other hand, you manipulate the molecular structure and change gas molecules into liquid molecules and transport it from there.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how much bigger the proposed LNG plant would be than the Phillips one that was built here?
Well, I really don't know the total engineering specs. I think it's somewhere around four times the original size of the original plant.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty big, yeah. It has to be in order to meet world trade conditions if you're going to do anything at all. I mean, there are some plants out there that are humongous in size. There's one operating off of Australia. It's a ship, LNG processing ship. This thing is 1,400 feet long. That's longer than an aircraft carrier. And they bring the gas on board and liquefy it and ship it right from there. It's a wow. monstrous thing.
Huh. Man. Now, they used to ship LNG to Tokyo, right?
We were the very first exporters of LNG in the United States of America. This plant shipped 100% of its cargo to Japan. And today we don't even ship any. At the very end, we were only shipping about 3%. But yes, this was the very first commercial LNG plant in the United States, and it exported everything that it made.
Yeah, 20, like, I'm trying to think of a number I read mm-hmm. once. Was it like 200 consecutive trips without a break or...
Probably. It was a 19-day round trip, and they had two tankers going all the time, one going, one coming back.
Yeah.
So Japan got into LNG in a really big way, not only for heating, but for processing and for refrigeration. You know, in order to convert LNG back to its natural state in order to burn it, you have to heat it up in order for it to gas off. You got to raise the temperature from 220 back up to ambient and burn it. Why waste all of that energy? Cold is as much energy as heat is, especially if you're talking about fish processing plants and food processing plants where refrigeration is desperately needed. So all your fish processing where they froze fish for international shipment, that cooled by LNG reheat.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, that's something.
Yeah.
Man. What do you think of the future of refining on in Nikiski is?
Only if you get exports, or imports, I should say. The amount of oil, known oil, left in the inlet is down considerably. I can't give you the exact barrels per day, but it isn't all that significant. In fact, the refinery consistently has to import oil because there isn't enough delivered here from the inlet. Now, having said that, the mystery of where the oil is still remains. There are known deposits of oil down through the inlet, known deposits on land, and the old magic Jurassic zone below 20,000 feet holds a magic key if anybody ever discovers where the real oil is coming from. So it's been rumored for many, many years that the oil migrates up from a lower level into the zones, and that the Jurassic really holds the key to that. We don't know because there's only been two wells drilled into the Jurassic that I know of.
Well, I was going to ask, is the challenge drilling that deep?
It is, yeah.
That's like four miles.
I believe the Sunfish drilled one well, and I believe the Granite Point drilled one well that went into the 20,000-foot level. Signs of hydrocarbons are there. How much? We don't know.
Huh, interesting. Are these platforms, they're required to be removed when they're all done someday, right?
Right. We just launched a study, an infrastructure study through CERCAC, of which I'm the chairman of the board there. And we want to look at the infrastructure and the pipeline systems leading to the platforms and what their life expectancy is, how many leaks we've had, how many spills we've had, how many we expect to have. The end of the platform's life requires that they be removed. Hillcorp is now the proud owner of virtually everything in the inlet. So that responsibility will fall either to them or their heirs. So.
And do you think that's, how far off do you think that might be?
Well, some of them have been in lighthouse state for a while. They're not all producing. And, you know, we don't know how long all of them are going to continue to produce. As long as Hillcorp can keep oil flowing, they'll continue to produce.
Is there some sort of trigger? You haven't been producing for X number of years. You got to take it down now?
Or? Not that I know of. Some of the old Texaco platforms and the Anna and the Bruce and I forget which other ones out there haven't been producing a lot, you know, and one produces gas to feed the others, and they call it lighthouse status.
I remember as a kid when they were first putting those up, flying back and forth to Dillingham and seeing them flare off there in the inlet. I thought that was pretty cool.
At one point, the production in the Cook Inlet was over 200,000 barrels a day. Today, it's insignificant compared to that.
That's actually pretty close to what the North Slope is putting out right now, isn't
it?
Well,
they're up above 500. They pretty well remain above. I think 517 last year on average.
Oh, okay. I thought it was 350 or so.
Yeah, no, not quite that low.
All right.
Strange things happen to the oil movement when it gets down that low. You shut the pipeline down.
Yeah.
You start batching through it or something.
Yeah. Huh. You know, it's 10:30. We've talked for a half an hour already.
Wow.
Let me put on a little break music here, and I'm going to get some more coffee. Do you need a refill?
Nah, I might take another one, yeah. And I'll make a phone call at the same time. Are we off air?
Momentarily. You're listening to the Kenai Conversation, and we're going to be back in just a few minutes. We're talking with John Williams about, well, pretty much everything. All right, we're back. Thank you to Dave Brubeck. Take five. I love that song, John.
Yeah. Brubeck was one of my favorites in my younger years.
Yeah. When you're in California, I mean, you were probably there during the birth of the cool.
Yeah, I left California in 62, actually. Moved to Fairbanks in June of 1962.
Oh, okay. Okay. Can we talk a little bit more about your CERCAC duties and what CERCAC is up to? What's going on there?
CERCAC, Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, as it's called, has been in business for about 28 years now. They're mandated by federal law, mandated to oversee and ensure the safe shipment of crude oil through the Cook Inlet. Any crude oil that moves comes under our oversight, if you will. That includes ships and pipelines and drill rigs and so forth and so on. We operate on a budget of about $1.5 million, none of which is taxpayers' dollars. We are an anomaly in that we're federally mandated and yet paid for by the oil companies that do the shipping and do the oil work. We do scientific research. We do scientific studies. We do mechanical studies, such as our pipeline infrastructure study that's going on right now. We participate as observers in oil spill activities, whether they be response to real oil spills or whether they just be training missions. We always set in on those and make sure everything's going. We're certified every 3 years or every year by the Coast Guard. Every 3 years, we have to take an audited look at it. But the Coast Guard is really our oversight to ensure that we're following federal law. And that's kind of the basis of it.
Mm-hmm. And there's another one for Prince William Sound as well.
Yes, the Prince William Sound RCAC is much larger than ours. I think their budget is about $5 million. To give you an idea, some of the scientific work that we've done, after the oil spill in Valdez, there was no baseline data of the ecology in the entire Cook Inlet or Prince William Sound. Nobody had done any of that. We have since covered shore-to-shore, coast-to-coast, the entire Cook Inlet, down into the Shelikof, around the corner. We know every inch of the land. We've photographed it. We have complete sets of photographs of miles and miles of beach. We can tell you every little inlet, every little cove, every little hazard point, every little collection point where oil might go in, and we can tell you what lives there, what doesn't live there, what kind of ecology there is, floral and fauna, miles and miles of records. We know about a lot about the beluga whale. We've studied the beluga whale under federal grants and things of that nature. So we've done a tremendous amount of work and set baselines for the future.
You know, when I was in Kodiak, I interviewed Susan Soppy about the aerial photograph project, and also the, I don't think it was ports of refuge, but inlets of refuge, identifying safe places for vessels in peril to go to, you know, if they're have some peril, they can go there and wait it out and get fixed.
Susan is one of the foremost scientists in the country when it comes to oceanography. She's done a huge amount of work with NOAA and others on the infrastructure.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that actually came into play a couple of years ago when Shell's Kulik rig snapped its tow lines on New Year's Eve and ran aground on Kodiak Island. Once they got it refloated, they brought it to a inlet of shelter and
safe harbor on the backside.
So is there much crosstalk between CIRCAC and the Prince William Sound RCAC?
As a matter of fact, yes. We just had a joint meeting in Anchorage where we hosted one another. They hosted us, actually. Thank you very much for... I have to get rid of this. They hosted us for dinner, and we had open talks, and our executive directors continuously talk back and forth with each other.
I'm not sure if you want to go here, but I had on my list of things to ask you just because you're such an experienced political observer. All this, well, let's call it lack of legislative ethics or congressional ethics or individual ethics of congressmen and legislators and what have you. It seems like the time has come that there's that some of these powerful men are getting their comeuppance.
Women power is coming to the surface. And as it rightly should, you know, it's a tough thing to go down there and spend a lot of time out of your life away from family and working for the general public who half the time doesn't appreciate what you're doing anyway. And it's another thing to get involved in ethical problems of that nature. You always hope that those that you elect to public office are ethical people, not only in matters of sexual conduct, but in matters of morality and other issues. And it's bad that sometimes that's not the case. And, you know, legislators are all human. We've had our legislators who have involved themselves in narcotics and cocaine and alcohol and have been, you know, virtually should have been removed from the legislature if they weren't. And it's too bad, but that's humanity.
Do you think that there is a different sea change in how I see two things happening here. I see the president not having any ramifications for his behavior or alleged behavior, and yet I see everybody else paying the ultimate political price for their behavior.
And isn't that a double-edged sword?
You know,
the sword does not cut both ways. It's a single-edged sword.
Yeah.
Just because he's the president doesn't mean that he has the right to do the things that he's done. You know, if he's a playboy, that's on his dime. If he's in the president of the United States, it's on my dime. And I do not agree with this. On the case of morality, I do not agree with the president in his way of life. But, of course, who am I to say?
Well, you're a taxpaying citizen of the country.
I know. That's true.
Do you think that the fact that he's not seeing any repercussions is going to become the new norm? I mean, basically, he's handling this by ignoring it. And in the past, you know, a scandal with, say, a president, they address it, and then it becomes the big scandal. He's ignoring it, and it's just kind of going away.
Kingdoms have fallen over this whole issue. You know, the King of England once abdicated his throne in favor of his paramour. I think the telltale will begin to be seen this year in the congressional elections. I think the congressional elections, for a variety of reasons, are going to see several seats in Congress change. So we'll see how that all plays out. The other thing that's going to play out very soon is this continuous involvement of Mueller, Special Prosecutor Mueller, in the whole case. This thing with Bannon coming out now and refusing to testify because he claims executive privilege, which is not correct. We'll see how that all plays out and where it leads. If it leads close to the presidency, there may be some change of thought caused by that. So I think that the whole thing is yet to be seen, is yet to play out.
Do you know what worries me is that things are going to go down the path that they look like they're going to go. Mm-hmm. Things are going to get worse for the president, with Mueller's investigation, et cetera, et cetera. And then later in the year, probably before the midterm elections, the president is going to start a war somewhere, or he's going to attack somebody, because presidents are always popular when they start a war.
Well, true. I'm just hoping that the Joint Chiefs of Staff and his cabinet can convince him otherwise. The United States has never started a war per se. You know, we've involved ourselves sometimes in areas where we shouldn't have after a war had already begun. But doesn't matter whether it's Vietnam or Korea or Japan, you know, in the early days, Germany. Those were all wars that were underway when we intervened. Let's hope that that remains the case. We have 15 years of intervention now in a war that should have been over a long time ago. But it's more now of, you know, a police action. The real question is, how long does the United States continue to be the policeman of the world? How long can we afford to police the world? Rome tried to do that in the early days. They tried to police the known world then, and it got to the point where they were running out of groceries on the front line, and that doesn't go well with the troops. So, in other words, our economics will dictate how much further we can go. We're already at $21 trillion in deficit. I was just talking to the grandkids last night about things of nature, financing war. I can recall many, many paychecks during the Vietnam crisis that I took home less than what I gave the government. We were in a 50% bracket or more. The difference then, and even in the Second World War, we paid for all of that as time went on, and we continued to pay for it until the debt was paid. It wasn't until the late 60s after Vietnam that we began to declare deficits and lower our taxes and take off that huge burden that it had cost us to be a free country. We're down now to the bracket of 14% or whatever it is. And that's not paying the bills. Somebody has got to pay the bills. We're not doing that anymore as we did. The burden was lifted. And the thing that makes it tough is that the new generation, the young generation, doesn't understand that. They've never been through it. They've never been through 50% tax. Half of everything you make goes to the government. You know, and yet they continue to want more, demand more, and spend more, but with no eye towards how it gets paid for.
Right. And in the meantime, it appears to me that the Russians and maybe the rest of the world is pulling a Ronald Reagan on us and forcing us to spend all our money on our military in hopes of bankrupting us.
Well, you know,
Ronald Reagan did to Russia.
That's a tactic. And, you know, speaking of how Reagan did that, Reagan, in all his wisdom, really used the credit card to do that. Russia had no idea what a credit card was. Ronald Reagan knew what a credit card could do. And I recall one budget that he signed that was heavily debted. It was like $800 billion in deficit spending. It was the biggest deficit spending budget we'd had up to that time. And as he signed it, he said, "This is the worst budget I've ever seen," he said, "but I'm going to sign it anyway." And he did. It was a huge deficit at the time. So had we have not learned about credit and how to run a credit card and how to put it off until next month, we wouldn't have won that war. 700 ship Navy, you know, unbelievable. So,
yep.
I was in Pearl Harbor during that period of time. There was Admiral Hernandez was the admiral in charge of the 7th Fleet. And I was visiting with him one afternoon on board his ship. And I said, "Admiral, I've been to Pearl several times." I said, "I've never seen this many ships in Pearl Harbor at one time. What's going on?" He said, "Let me tell you, sir," he said, "when you're running a 700 ship Navy, you got to park them sometime." And that's what we were doing.
Oh, boy. Let's switch gears here a little bit, maybe. How do you think our new borough mayor's doing?
Well, I haven't really had a chance to observe his operation. I hesitate to make any comment at all until we see just exactly what his plan is. He's only been in office a couple months. I understand he has had some of his key people leave him. Whether they'll be replaced or who they'll be replaced with is yet to be seen. The public safety director, Scott Walden, left. Pat Malone, who was one of his maintenance people in charge of maintenance over there, has quit and retired. So we'll just have to wait and see what transpires.
Mm-hmm. What's on the horizon for in your mind for the borough? Or
you notice my silence?
Yeah,
it's a tough picture out there. Things are slow. You mentioned earlier the new norm. I think we're floating into a new norm economically. What you're seeing is what you're going to have for a while. I don't see any massive new infusion of capital and monies and finances and economics and all of the things that it takes to grow. I don't see that happening anytime soon. So it's just kind of go as you go.
You know, we were talking before we went on about the economics around here and how there were, empty storefronts in Kenai and Soldotna. But the area of Kay Beach, Kay Beach Road, between the towns, is booming. I mean, there are huge buildings, brand new, going up left and right here. What's going on there?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is availability of land, of course. The other is the very simple fact that Kenai Peninsula Borough is a second-class borough. With that, they have no building inspector whatsoever. There is no requirements regarding how you put your structure together or how you build it. The only thing you're limited by is who's loaning you the money and how they want to see it done. Barring that, if you have your own money, you can go in there and build anything you want. Now, the difference in that and, say, Kenai is that Kenai subscribes to the International Building Code. And when you subscribe to a building code, You write a one-page resolution saying that you subscribe to the building code, but it doesn't stop there. When you sign that resolution, you subscribe to every page of that building code without exception, and you cannot depart from what the building code says. So it makes it tough sometimes for a young couple to build a new building, to start a new business. I'll give you a good example. Rents got, pretty low, pretty slow around here, and my office building, being a four-place office building, was totally empty. I thought, well, I've been in the apartment house business before. Why don't I convert the four offices to four nice small apartments? So I went ahead and made plans to do it without contacting the building inspector first. When I brought him in to see what it would take to meet code, I found out that at a minimum it would have cost me $40,000 to remodel the building in order to make it habitable under the code. So I immediately abandoned the idea. And see, those are the things that you run into. I know of another group that is building a new building where the old Larry's Club is at, and they have run into lots of consternation and discussion with the building inspector over that building. And those are things that hold you up. Had they have built over on K Beach, nobody would have said a word. Build the building, and that's it.
That, I guess there's a trade-off. I mean, if you live in a city and you want nice things, you have a code.
Mm-hmm.
But are you telling me that these cities that are in the borough, outside of city limits, like they don't even have to comply with ADA?
Which cities are we talking about? The incorporated cities?
No, I mean outside the cities.
Okay, outside like the borough.
Yeah.
If you're not an incorporated area, no, ADA is different.
Oh,
ADA
okay.
is a federal law.
Oh, okay.
So that's far different.
That's something different completely.
Right, yeah.
Right. But they could put studs in their wall 48 inches on center, and they could have exposed wires and all put manner of things.
You could put a coffee shop in a treehouse, see what you want to do with it.
I always remember one time a fella came before the... Well, it came before everybody, really. I think it was basically the Chamber of Commerce. You probably remember his name. He wanted to raise hogs commercially on the peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I first found out that there was really no zoning, and you could probably put a hog farm wherever you wanted, really.
Put it in the gravel pit next door to your house.
Yeah, and it's I guess it all goes back to the leave-me-alone pioneer spirit of Alaskans, huh?
The difference between first, second, and third class, and as well dictated to in the Constitution and in the Boundary Commission's rules and so forth, you can class yourself a third-class borough, which gives you very, very limited powers, very virtually nothing, mostly for educational purposes. If the borough wants to own the schools, and it might open up some bonding for you. Second-class borough, then, if I remember all of them right, can lend itself towards waste management, road powers, public safety, economic development, and there's another one. I can't think of the other one right now.
Oh, is it health?
Yeah. The other things that can be done is by the citizens can enlarge government themselves. A good example is Nikiski. They have their own fire service area, so they've created a service area under the borough for Nikiski. They've also voted in a senior citizens service area, and that requires a separate tax, senior citizen service area. We've got, out in the other parts of the borough, there are, probably are some other ones I can't think right now of service areas, road service areas, recreational service areas, gas line service areas, things of that nature can be voted in by the people but are not necessarily allowable under state law for the borough to enter into. So, and of course, first class then, for example, the city of Kenai is first class, home rule, with its own charter. That means it's like its own constitution. We can do anything and everything available to us in state or federal law, as long as it's within the law, federal or state law. We can make our own rules and do anything we want with them. And that's how the city of Kenai operates.
Now, I recall when I was on the City of Kenai's Planning and Zoning Commission for a few years, The decisions there still had to go through the borough's Planning and Zoning Commission.
Yes, we had a joint, that's the other, planning. And the reason that that's in there for oversight by the borough is to ensure that roads coming from the city into the borough meet up with each other. Right-of-ways, things of nature dealing with land platting, things of that nature. You know, up in our country here, every township requires a correction of the curvature of the earth with regards to their lines, their road lines and section lines and things like that. Those all need to be guarded, and they need to be made sure that they're proper. That's why all plats flow through the borough. But generally speaking, by the time they get to the borough from the city, it's merely a rubber stamp issue.
Uh-huh. So first class with the charter, Soldotna adopted that.
Yes, they just recently adopted the first-class status. The only other first-class status in the borough was Seward and Seldovia, believe it or not. Yeah. Seldovia adopted first-class home rule right after statehood.
Wow. We only have a minute or so left. What have you got planned for this year?
Well, you know, I'm continuing on with my little fire truck project. We're going to build a shelter to put the fire truck under so that everybody can admire it and see it and think about the history of the city.
Where's that going?
It's going to go right by the fire station. So other than that, I plan on staying a little bit low profile. I'm not running for anything, and I'm ahead in the polls, believe it or not.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I was following that fire truck project the last couple of years online.
Brought you a copy of our little booklet that we built. I'll see that you get one.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
History of the fire truck.
Yeah. When are you going to be putting that up? Sometime this summer?
The shelter, yes. Yeah, we'll do it this summer.
Oh, that'd be great.
Well, it's been a pleasure being with you, Jay.
You too,
John. Kind of
brings
back a lot of old memories.
Yeah, I always appreciate you coming on, and hopefully when you get back before too long, you know, when it gets 100 degrees in Tucson, we'll have you back on the air.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to the Kenai Conversation. I'm Jay Barrett. We've had our guest, Mayor John Williams, mayor of the city of Kenai and the borough of Kenai, and our own political and social and historical guru here on KDLL. This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL, 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.